think I see it going right across my deck here now. I did not up in his vicinity, but no, I didn't.
Alright, so this is Goose 2. Roger, thanks for that information, sir, and I'll get back to you if we come up with anything. Over.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name's Tanner, and I'll be one of your hosts today. I'll be joined here in just a minute by Taylor. Before we get to that, we have some patrons to shout out. We have quite a few since it's been a while since we've recorded. So, big thank you to Michael, DJ, Kevin, Unseen Academic, Caleb, and Darius. Really appreciate your support over on Patreon. I hope you enjoy the back catalog of episodes, and we are also working on some cool new stuff for April over there. Taylor, how's it going?
It's pretty good. Getting over some allergies right now, so I feel like I'm breathing like a bulldog, but other than that, pretty good. How about you?
Got that dog in you, and it is a it is a wheezing, congested bulldog.
Yeah, it is a wheezing, congested bred for the ring, not for the streets bulldog. The show ring, not the fighting ring.
That's what I was thinking. I guess a few things to note before we get into our normal stuff here. We were on a podcast called Failure to Launch.
Yes.
Where the podcast that we both really enjoy. It's about space disasters. They basically do what we do, but for space instead of the sea. It was a lot of fun. We talked about the Soyuz 11 disaster, the Soviet space program. Learned a lot over the course of those two episodes. Really enjoyed talking to the guys about that. So definitely go give them a listen if you have not already. We posted about it a bit on social media.
Yeah, that was a good time. I'm glad we got to do that. And it is kind of cool to see another show that does like a very similar format and everything that we do, but on a different topic.
What have you been up to since we recorded last?
Mostly it has been watching the Fallout series on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. It's amazing.
I've heard basically nothing but good things, which is funny because when they dropped the trailer a few months ago, I heard nothing but bad things about how terrible it was going to be.
Well, I feel like Fallout people are they're all some of the most horrible people in video games sometimes. Like, I love Fallout. It's my favorite series. But, God, they can complain and complain. And, they hold up New Vegas as, the Holy Grail when New Vegas is very well written, but it's also glitchy and buggy and not that fun sometimes. So there's a lot of those kind of people. And I think they won a lot of those people over, when it actually dropped, because it was really well done. The Ghoul and Lucy were both really fun characters. Yeah, it was great. I think that they nailed the spirit of the game because they kind of walked that line of humor and gore, and a lot of black humor and stuff in it. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Walton Goggins is in it, right?
Yeah, he's the ghoul. And then Lucy is Ella. Can't think of what her name is.
Ella Fitzgerald.
Ella Purnell. And she was also perfect because she kind of walked that fine line of being kind of ignorant of the ways of the wasteland because she was a vault dweller, but also being a very capable person. So it's fun to watch.
So the main character of the game that you have to play.
Essentially, she is the stand-in for how you would play the game for the first time, because at first you're very trusting probably, and you don't realize that literally everyone's trying to scam you all the time in the Fallout world. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's only, I think, 8 episodes, so it really didn't take that long.
Have you seen Michael Rapaport yet?
Yeah, he dies almost.
Oh, that's good.
Almost, yeah. You'll actually, the only scene that he's really in, he is attacked by a large bear, a large radioactive bear. So,
oh, cool. I would love to watch Michael Rapaport die in Fallout.
You can do it. But yeah, that's the big thing I've been up to. Like I said, I highly recommend it. It's been fun.
Cool. Yeah, I definitely want to check that out. We got a few things we got to finish. We still have to finish Reservation Dogs.
Nice. That is one that I've been wanting to check out.
And we have to start and finish The Great. We have a new season of Fargo to catch up on. We have so much stuff to do. This is as we're finally watching 30 Rock all the way through, which we're really enjoying.
Nice. Is there like a narrative arc to 30 Rock?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's very comparative to like The Office in that there's like running things that come back to it.
Okay.
And let's see, reading wise, this was a great book. I read it in like 3 days. It's a book called Hamas Contained by Tariq Bakoni. And it details the history of Hamas for what it is as a group. So looking into the social, the political, and the military development, you know, starting from like the first Intifada and then developing over time into what it is now. And it's very well written from the perspective of analyzing them as a group that has strengths and weaknesses and successes and failures, mm-hmm. rather than the kind of boogeyman monolith that you would see them as in basically any sort of American media, and kind of presenting how they have navigated the landscape of the Palestinian resistance, mm-hmm. and kind of how they exist in that ecosystem, you know, along with the other resistance groups, the ways in which, with some notable exceptions, the extent to which the different resistance factions complement one another rather than compete with one another. Mm-hmm. So like it talks a lot about Hamas's coexistence for the most part with groups like Islamic Jihad. And of course it goes into a lot of the stuff with Hamas and Fatah.
Yeah. I think understanding it as like a local political organization is important for understanding why and what they may be doing at certain times, or why they may feel they have to do a certain thing. I think understanding why domestically that might be important to them is huge, rather than just, like you said, seeing them as some big monolith of, you know, scary Arab people.
Even the designation of them as a terrorist group, as you see with us and Ansar Allah, like that is a very
fluid.
It's very fluid. It's just literally depending on the situation at the time. But even that, I mean, they, you know, as he points out there, you know, even just the label of terrorist, any label that can cover ISIS and Al Qaeda and Hamas is not really even a label worth using, if that's mm-hmm. what you're going to call it. It's very interesting, I would say. You know, obviously Hamas is a little bit divisive, you'd say, in the current media landscape. It's a very good read. I would highly recommend it for anyone who would like to legitimately learn a bit more about how Hamas functions, and more importantly, why, I think, is also useful.
I think even if you have some very strong reservations about a group like Hamas, I don't think it's a bad thing to inform yourself about who and what they are.
I would also say from both sides. I mean, even the title of it, Hamas Contained, sounds a bit defeatist from a resistance perspective. The book is from 2018, I want to say. And kind of within his wrap up, you know, his analysis up to the point, like the things that have occurred, obviously, since that book was published, fit within, you know, the paradigm of his analysis of saying mm-hmm. this has always been a series of escalation and de-escalation and, you know, boiling and simmering. It was a really informative read, especially a lot of the people who are the big people in the movement now. You know, your Ismail Haniyeh, Yahya Sinwar, and kind of seeing their development as the figures in the movement.
Yeah, that sounds like an interesting read.
Well, I guess talking about that, obviously the genocide in Gaza continues. And kind of on a related note, we've seen college campuses blowing up with student protests. So it's nice to see some level of support there for Palestine. I know, obviously, Columbia, because everybody likes watching Shai Davidi freak out when he teaches class. I don't know. I feel bad for his students waiting on feedback for their, I don't know, business essays or something, whatever.
We didn't write essays in business school.
Waiting for feedback on their finger paintings. So anyway, Beyond the Breakers supports student solidarity with Palestine. Well, let's get to it, shall we? It was my birthday last week, a week ago.
It was.
I wanted, kind of like last year with the Spanish Armada, the kernel of it was that I wanted to do something for my birthday. So this is this year's version of that. A multi-part episode that no one has asked for. We are going to do a two-part episode, two-part series on the Battle of Lepanto.
Awesome.
You familiar with the Battle of Lepanto? We referenced it a few times in the Armada episode, but
yeah, only in like the vaguest of terms. I know that it happened. I know there were some Habsburgs there, I believe.
Always a good guess in the 1500s, 1600s. There were probably some Habsburgs there.
I don't actually, I don't even know if I know. Did it happen? Is it like off the coast of Libya? Where are we talking about?
Other side of the Mediterranean. We're going to be looking at the coast of Greece, the west coast of Greece. But we're not going to be there for a while. We got some other stuff to do. So there will be a lot of tie-ins with the Armada, and we'll try to highlight those when possible. Some recurring themes, some recurring characters. We're not that far away in terms of time. We did refer to it a few times in the Armada series because in 1588, many of those Spanish commanders that were sailing off the Armada were veterans of Lepanto 17 years earlier. Among them was Alvaro de Bazan, the Marquis of Santa Cruz, the original commander of the Armada, and kind of just all around fixer for Philip in the 1580s. We will see him in these episodes. In the Armada episodes, we also talked about the differing naval strategies employed by the English and the Spanish. And in this episode, we will see some of the experiences that influenced how Spain waged naval warfare. But it's not just Spain we've got to discuss. We also have to talk about Venice, a couple of popes, crusader military orders, and of course, the big one, the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, this gives big crusade vibes, actually.
Yep, that is what the Pope thinks also.
That's it's just weird that it's 1571.
It's a bit late to be crusading, don't we think, boys?
Okay, what, 80 years after Columbus sailed to North America?
It's a bit much. So we've got to talk a little bit. We haven't really gotten a chance. Have we ever had a reason to talk about the Ottoman Empire on the show?
Other than when I was reading the book about them, no. This is, so time-wise, I'm trying to place this a little bit. This is kind of the like the apex or like the beginning of the decline of the Ottomans, like the long kind of decline that they have until World War One.
Kind of. I mean, some people would say that Lepanto is kind of like the turning point.
Like, things don't really get better for them.
I mean, they still are besieging Vienna in like the mid 1600s.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
They have a while, and that's kind of one thing we'll talk about in the last episode is the way that Lepanto kind of draws the curtain across what we think of today as the spheres of influence in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. You have the southern and eastern shore that's very much the Islamic world. And then you have the northern coast of, you know, southern Europe and things that historically Christian Europe. And Lepanto kind of ends up being the thing that more or less establishes that. Not that they really knew it at the time.
Right.
The Ottomans. You and I have both been reading a bit about the Ottomans recently. We can activate some of our prior knowledge here. The Ottomans, they expanded into the Balkans starting in about the 1350s. Going around Constantinople to do this, slowly choking off Constantinople, modern day Istanbul, which ultimately fell in 1453. And depending on one's perspective, you could call this the final death of the Roman Empire. Byzantines.
The Byzantines would have said that.
They didn't call themselves the Byzantines. They would have thought of themselves as the Roman Empire.
I think that was one of the things I learned in that Ottoman book that was the most surprising. Is that you legitimately could, like, they have a somewhat legitimate claim to that.
More than somewhat. I mean, you'd say, like, yeah, I think looking objectively at it, rather than
emotionally
having your heart in Rome, you'd say, like, well, yeah, this is the same polity that we're looking at here. Mm-hmm.
Even though they're not all Italian Roman guys.
Right. Even though they're speaking the Greek. And, like, not even that, you know, when Mehmed conquers Constantinople, he very much feels like, I'm the Roman emperor now. He doesn't think he's ending anything. You know, he would have said, no, I'm taking this over. I have the mandate of heaven now.
Yeah, that's another thing that was very surprising to me is, yeah, he didn't see it as like conquering the Romans. It's like, I'm Caesar.
I am the Romans now. So with the Red Apple conquered, the Ottomans continued to push over land into Serbia, Bosnia, Hungary, Moldavia, all those places over there.
All the places where there's just no trouble for the rest of their history and everyone gets along.
By the mid-1500s, they're firmly established in those areas. It's during this time you get some of those great historic Ottoman victories. And so, by contrast, the great historic European Christian defeats.
The ones we don't talk about as much.
Belgrade fell to the Ottomans in 1521, having sustained multiple sieges. This is a big early victory in the reign of a guy named Suleiman. We will come to know as Suleiman the Magnificent in English, in the European world.
Yeah, I think it's interesting learning more about him and his interactions with Europe and stuff. It's weird that he would just send letters to the king and queen in England and France and places like that. Like, it is a little strange to think about.
And so this opens the doors for the clash at Mohacs, which is a just enormously cataclysmic defeat for the Kingdom of Hungary. Leads to about 20,000 dead on the Hungarian side, about 10 times what the Ottomans suffer. So Belgrade is fallen, Hungary is shattered, the Habsburg lands of Central Europe, as well as Italy, are now exposed. And so, like we talked about, like the Siege of Vienna later on, like, this is going to be the battleground for quite some time. This is essentially the frontier between, you know, East and West is right here through these parts of the Balkans.
What's England up to right now? Are they just standing by and kind of just watching this go on? And
so at this point, this would be the early reign of Henry VIII.
Oh, yeah, he's busy making a new religion.
Early to mid. So you've got stuff like the Reformation going on around this time.
He's got local problems.
Yeah, I mean, he has plenty of stuff to deal with. And actually kind of like in the Mary Rose episode, we talked about his back and forths with the Kingdom of France. And like, this is the other thing that France is up to at this time, is dealing with the Ottoman Empire in a way that not too many Europeans would approve of. We'll talk about them later, though. So at this point in the early decades of the 1500s, Venetian ambassador to Rome, Marco Minio, wrote in 1522.
It appears that they have in their hands the keys to all Christendom, since they have taken Belgrade in such a way that they can easily penetrate into the vitals of the Christians. And this they say openly, and it is believed that His Excellency will not undertake an enterprise against anyone except the Christians.
That is a quote that I got from Lester Libby.
Scooter's brother.
In Venetian Views of the Ottoman Empire, from the Peace of 1503 to the War of Cyprus. But as the Ottomans are expanding their territory over land, they're also becoming more of a threat in the Mediterranean. We think of the Ottomans as the land-based empire for good reason. Mm-hmm. But of course, this episode will center all around their naval power. The Ottoman army gets most of the laurels for their conquests, you know, modern-day Turkey, the Balkans. The Ottoman Navy did play a role in a lot of those victories, too. From Andrew Hess in The Evolution of the Ottoman Seaborne Empire in the Age of the Oceanic Discoveries, 1453 to 1525.
The Ottomans broke through the massive walls of Constantinople in the spring of 1453 and vigorously took up the Byzantine inheritance, which included, among other things, a long naval history. Whatever may have been the influence of the past on the conqueror, the Turkish possession of the sea route between the Aegean and Black Seas vividly demonstrated to the Italians that the land power of the Ottomans had taken on a major naval dimension. On the other hand, the uneven performance of their fleet during the siege demonstrated to the Ottomans the maritime requirements of an empire ruled from Istanbul.
This thing that the Ottomans have wanted for so long, and then they finally have it, and kind of taking on some of the magnitude of like, okay, what does this entail actually to govern from here? So notably at the Siege of Constantinople, one of the famous stories is that with the Golden Horn inaccessible, the Ottomans had simply carried a lot of their ships over land, launched them into the Golden Horn, suddenly exposing this wall that previously they'd not been able to have access to. And that contributes to the fall of the city. But the Navy had also failed to stop some relief vessels from reaching the city. So like you kind of have some wins and some losses there for the Ottoman Navy. You have some ingenuity, but you also have some failures. like a second baseman who can make amazing plays, but then throws it in the dugout on a routine grounder. So after the city fell, the Navy also played a role in mopping up the remnants of the Byzantine Empire in the Black Sea. By and large, the Ottoman Navy served a logistical purpose more so than a strict combat role. Not really looking for a fight at sea, but just to deliver troops and siege weaponry where they needed to go to allow the Ottomans to play to their real strengths on land. And that's not weird at this time. Like, in that sense, it's the same as the Armada.
Yeah, I think it's also, I mean, even the British Empire is built because of that. Like, because of their ability to deploy troops and resources places, that was the most important part, was figuring out the logistics.
Yeah, it's very much like a way to just project land power longer distance.
I mean, it's like, what, that's the role of the modern day aircraft carrier in our Navy, right?
This would remain true even after the capture of Constantinople, but this shiny new capital is going to influence the Ottomans' ability to wage naval war, but maybe more importantly, to wage commerce. So again, here from Andrew Hess.
As soon as Mehmet took control of his new capital, he promptly showed that Istanbul was to be no ash heap of Byzantine and Latin naval structures. Maintaining the fleet's old facilities at Gallipoli, the Sultan now collected carpenters, merchants, and sailors from the coastal regions of the empire for the naval service of Istanbul.
Upon acquiring a maritime technology that was largely Italian, Mehmet ordered into production naval arsenals to supply galleys for a war fleet.
At the same time, the Ottoman ruler encouraged the settlement in Istanbul of Christian merchants who had engaged in sea trade, aware that the growth of the city was related to its economic prosperity. Mehmet also granted tax exemptions to the trades, repopulated the city with artisans and laborers, and launched a public works program. I think that's really interesting. Mentioning here, like, it talks about bringing in the Christian merchants and mm-hmm. stuff like that, because that was one thing I learned reading that book, is you could live very well being Jewish, being Muslim, being Christian in the Ottoman Empire, as long as you were kind of willing to play the games they wanted you to play.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you could, like, bring value and help them, they were pretty merit focused.
One of the big sources for this was Roger Crowley's Empires of the Sea. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit later on, I forget which figures it is here, but it kind of talks about how in kind of the upper echelon Ottoman command structure, I think it's when he's talking more about the siege of Malta, I think, but saying how you've kind of got situations where if you're an ethnic Turk in those circles, like, you are kind of the odd person out, because, like, mm-hmm. there are Serbs, there are Egyptians, there are Kurds, there are Hungarians, there are Italian renegades. There's all kinds of people operating in these circles. And like you said, like, as long as you're willing to, you know, play the game, you are welcome to hang out here. And you could look at something like the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. Mm-hmm. The first thing that the Ottoman Sultan does is say, like, the Alhambra Declaration, saying, come on in.
Right.
We can definitely use your services. In the 1450s and 60s, the Navy began to take islands in the Aegean, which brings them into conflict with La Serenissima, the Republic of Venice, who we are going to talk about plenty.
Is Italy still, like, 15 different little kingdoms at this point?
It's not quite as fractured as all that. I mean, you have your major powers. Like, you've got the city-states. Like, you've got, like, Venice and Genoa. But then, like, most of southern Italy is controlled by the King of Spain.
Okay.
And then, like, you've got the Papal States. It is a bunch of different pieces, but it's not like Germany status with
right.
all these little warring states. It's wide swaths of control by a handful of people, really. Like we saw with Philip in the Armada episodes. He was the Duke of Milan before he was the King of Spain, because Milan was owned by the King of Spain.
That was another thing I remember from reading that, is like how Venice, like, sometimes the Ottomans were their friends, sometimes they weren't. It just depends.
Yeah, they're an interesting set of, like, object lessons in how do you exist between two large expanding empires.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what we get into here in a second. We will talk about Venice quite a bit over these next two episodes. Quoting here from Lester Libby, writing in the 16th Century Journal,
In the early decades of the 16th century, the Republican city-state of Venice fought almost continually to safeguard its independence in a world increasingly dominated by huge centralizing monarchies. The Venetians obtained a guarantee of their land frontiers at the expense of accepting a passive and subsidiary role in European affairs.
So the world's becoming a tough place for a little city-state like Venice.
Uh-huh.
And this isn't just Venice. Obviously, they have overseas possessions also throughout the Aegean. They have islands that they control. We'll talk about what they do in Cyprus in the next episode. And they have essentially like a slave plantation colony in Cyprus.
Oh, no.
Which is not what you really think about, I guess, in the 1500s Mediterranean. But yeah, they do that. They're definitely getting squeezed between these two powers that are rivals with each other. If they lean too far to one side, the other one is going to be displeased with them. So yeah, we'll talk about Venice a lot. To a lesser extent, we'll talk about their rival in Genoa, who has her own competing network of territories in the Mediterranean. And so for the Ottomans, with their growing emphasis on sea power, in addition to clashing with the Italians, the Habsburgs, they would also need to lock horns with the Order of Knights of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem, better known as the Hospitallers. You know, like from the video game Assassin's Creed.
I was going to say, aren't they one of the bad guys in Assassin's Creed?
Sometimes, yes, they are. Except in Kingdom of Heaven, they are the good guys because they're not the Templars, who are bloodthirsty murderers, unlike the rest of the Crusaders, who are nice. The Templars are long gone by this point, but the Hospitallers are still kicking.
I guess I didn't know that. I guess I didn't realize that they were around that long.
The Hospitallers still exist today, technically. Huh. I think they're just called the Knights of Malta now.
Oh, is that what that is? That would make sense. Is it just like a charity organization now or something?
They still lead crusades. They just don't get as much.
It wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, they still exist. They still have a Grand Master. His name is John Dunlap.
I don't think any organization that has a Grand Master, unless it's like chess, is probably okay.
They operate out of Rome.
Of course they do.
All right. So after the loss of the last Crusader outpost of Acre in 1291, the Hospitallers had transplanted their headquarters to the large southern Aegean island of Rhodes off the coast of Anatolia. The first Ottoman siege of Rhodes was in 1480. That was unsuccessful. But as the Ottomans so often tend to do, they came back. That's kind of the thing reading, you know, a lot of the Ottoman histories and stuff, thinking of it from a European perspective, is just how depressing it would all seem, because there's so many places, Belgrade as another example, where they're besieged multiple times, you know, every few decades. There just does not seem to be any way to actually stop the Ottoman Empire.
I mean, it's sort of like the last little vestiges of like the Mongol horde, right? Of like, it's just a matter of time that they're going to be back. Yeah, it's like,
there's just nothing you can do about this. Mm-hmm. So Rhodes fell to the Ottomans in 1522 after a six-month siege. Another big win for Suleiman. And despite that vigorous defense, and maybe because of it, the Knights of Rhodes were actually allowed to leave the island in good order, weapons and all. So this is a very, I guess, respectful ordeal, you'd say, once it's all said and done.
Fair play situation.
One of the types of things that you can see how that would enhance Suleiman's reputation in Europe. I mean, there is a reason that we refer to him as the Magnificent. He's definitely seen as, you know, somewhat more grand or different than your typical sultan. So quoting here from Roger Crowley in Empires of the Sea.
Muffled news of the siege was relayed across the Mediterranean world. Though they did nothing, the potentates of Europe understood how much Rhodes mattered. It was the dam holding back the Ottoman maritime advance. The Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, foresaw that the island's loss would open up the central seas. The Ottomans would proceed to a seaborne assault on Italy, and finally to ruin and destroy all Christendom.
All right, so it's domino theory, once again.
It literally is.
But in this case, it does actually appear to be happening.
Picturing an Ottoman Operation Sea Lion being planned, but like never actually run.
Being expelled from their island fortress at Rhodes, The Hospitallers are in need of a new home, and Grandmaster Philippe Villiers de Lisle Adam, which is a cooler name than John Dunlap, he had to ask around the monarchs of Europe to see who might have something sitting around for them. You know,
this is kind of like when Wagner Group got like told that they couldn't fight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good parallel. You don't got to go home, but you can't stay here.
Don't get on the plane.
And asking around, see, does anybody have any island fortresses sitting around? Craggy hilltop bastions that we could chill in for a little bit.
In London, Henry VIII had received the old man graciously and given him guns, but only Charles provided the possibility of a permanent home. He offered the barren and impoverished island of Malta, south of Sicily, in the path of every corsair raid on the Italian coast. So is he pretty much like putting them up as a barrier against these raids?
Kind of a mutual benefit thing where the Hospitallers want somewhere where they can, you know, be and fight the Turk, and then Charles V wants someone who will fight the Turk and not use up his resources too much.
So he's the Belarus in this Wagner sandwich.
They want to use them as a buffer, and hey, they want to be used as a buffer, so
that's kind of a win-win.
More power to them, really. And I think what's interesting here is that in 1522, it's interesting that, you know, this is before the English Reformation has happened, so this is still when, you know, Henry VIII is considered not just a good Catholic, but like one of the great Catholic kings of Europe. When this Catholic military order needs a new home, he's one of the people they go to.
Yeah, that is interesting, because it won't be too long before that's not a thing.
Let's see, you talked about the Corsair raids on the Italian coast, right? Mm-hmm. And there's going to be some raids on Italy around the Mediterranean, many of them coming at the hands of Hayreddin Pasha, better known to Europe as Barbarossa.
I swear Pasha must be like the Smith or Johnson of Turkish names. They're all Pasha.
It's a title rather than a name.
It's like still, is it currently like a title?
It might be used more as like a name now, but maybe they did away with that during like Ataturk's reforms. Because I know he had some Pashas hanging out with him also. You see it also with a lot of the sea captains have race as their, that's just a title that means like admiral, basically.
I just know I've talked to more than one truck driver with the name Pasha.
Let's see. So we have Barbarossa, not to be confused with Frederick Barbarossa. I do want to do a bonus episode about Barbarossa, because he's a fascinating character. His older brother was the original Barbarossa until he was killed.
They reused the name?
Yes. They also dyed his beard red so that the name would be accurate. And then we also got kind of his protege, Turgut Reis, also referred to as Dragut in Europe. He has my favorite nickname, the Drawn Sword of Islam. Got to do some cool stuff to get that name.
You would think.
So for the sake of time, we won't really talk about either of them too much in these episodes. Because again, I want to do a bonus episode about them.
I will say it is funny that there's such a panic around Islam when the Turks generally don't care all that much.
You'll actually see later on, towards the end here, you have a lot of admiration for how the Ottoman Empire functions from a lot of your kind of European, the diplomat class, who kind of see how it works, and they say, God, I wish that our country worked like this. Looking at things like, you know, the laws and how people behave. Not that the Ottoman Empire was some paragon of like,
right.
You had all the same problems you have anywhere.
It was just an empire that had to cobble together a bunch of different types of people.
So let's talk about some Ottoman-Venetian wars.
Okay.
So the ultimate goal of this episode, the Battle of Lepanto, will have at its heart the conflict between Venice and the Ottomans. So we should talk about some of the wars that led up to it. The first Ottoman-Venetian War is the label that's applied to those Ottoman conquests after the fall of Constantinople, where Venetian territories in the Black Sea, the Aegean, and around Greece were either conquered outright or forced into tributary status. Venice would get a lot of experience during the 15th and 16th centuries in deciding when it made sense to fight and when it made more sense to buy off the Turks. This would lead to the other European powers somewhat rightfully being suspicious of Venetian dealings with the Ottomans. kind of seemingly at any time they might decide to pull out of whatever alliance they've joined with the Europeans if they thought they could cut themselves a separate deal.
Right.
Kind of how they worked. This is not a super, 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 super long time after the Venetians did sack Constantinople in the Fourth Crusade.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of have a history of doing these things. And Venice isn't really unique in Europe in this regard. We were talking about France.
Uh-huh.
France, in this era, starting in 1536, shocks Christendom by engaging in an Ottoman alliance. You even have Turkish ships putting in at the harbor of Toulon. Even the French who are there witnessing this are like, what is happening right now?
There were racist things written, like, in some of the documents that, like, of the time that would, like, be just as comfortable in, like, 1950s Alabama.
Probably.
They recited some of them in that book about the Ottomans that I read. I was like, wow, this is evergreen.
That alliance would operate kind of off and on for a couple hundred years, actually, until like the 1700s. I think they have stuff, you know.
It's just wild to think that the Ottoman Empire exists in the 1700s. It is. It's weird.
The fact that the empire we're talking about right now fighting against the city-state of Venice will like ultimately meet its demise because of World War I is pretty mm-hmm. crazy.
Yeah, it really is.
Or I guess after. I don't know enough about the history to say it was because of World War I.
I think World War I just finished it off mostly.
It didn't help a lot of people.
It is weird though to think that you can go from an empire that fought the Roman Empire to mm-hmm. fighting the British Empire.
Yeah, that is really crazy when you put it that way. So both Venice and the Ottomans kind of feeling each other out as to how to best employ their naval forces while not really looking to risk a major engagement.
Just throwing some jabs, seeing what's going on.
Andrew Hess writes,
unable to develop sufficiently powerful Christian support and limited by its small population, the Venetians found it difficult to use their superior naval ability to stop the Muslims' simultaneous advance on land and sea.
On the other side of the conflict, the Ottomans, fearful of an open sea battle with the Italians, kept their galleys well within range of their own lands, so that Muslim numerical superiority on land could prevent a successful Venetian admiral from taking Ottoman territory.
Before 1480, the war on sea, therefore, worked itself out in a series of raids and indecisive confrontations, in which the Muslim fleet remained virtually untested in the art of large-scale galley warfare.
Even the big names that people know, you know, from, you know, the Ottoman Navy, your Barbarossas, Turgut, they're not famous for defeating Christian fleets in battle. They're famous for raiding coastlines, taking prisoners, and bringing them back to sell in Constantinople. Nobody really wants a sea battle.
I mean, I feel like that is something that's true throughout the history of warfare for the most part. I mean, look at the German Navy. In World War I, mm-hmm. it never leaves harbor. They kind of get the same vibes here that no one ever wants to have that large Navy battle at sea.
I guess you could kind of apply that to military history in general.
Mm-hmm.
You read about a lot of, you know, wars throughout history, and in a lot of these very famous wars from like the Renaissance era, the medieval era, there's like maybe one big clash, you know, of like open battle.
That's like reading the English Civil War history that I read.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many of those are like 50 guys and 100 guys squaring off, yelling at each other.
Kind of, I guess, the nature of things. It's really expensive to get a lot of guys together and have a battle. It's really hard.
Yeah, it costs a lot of money. You have to have Congress pass and send you a big check to keep it going.
Got to use your PTO. So the second Ottoman-Venetian War of 1499 to 1503 resulted in the Ottomans taking a few territories from Venice in the Balkans, but with Venice also managing to capture the Ionian Sea islands of Kefalonia and Ithaca.
All of this is just trading little pieces back and forth?
Yeah, basically. Kefalonia changes hands a couple of times. Several of these islands do.
And it's also funny because I bet the people that live there don't even care. So, like, whatever, I just want to plant my crops and do my
thing. I would say to the extent that, like, as long as you don't literally burn down my farm.
Yeah, like, I don't care.
The most noteworthy development here is that you do have Ottoman fleets challenging Venice at sea and winning.
Confident that by the summer of 1499, the Ottoman fleet could compete with Christian flotillas, Bayezid II commanded his viziers to implement the naval policy laid down by his father.
The galleys of the Ottomans, including two ships of extraordinary size, sailed toward the Greek peninsula in order to make the sea the frontier.
The ensuing battles off the southwest portion of the Morea resulted in the defeat of the Venetian fleet and the Ottoman conquest by 1503 of Lepanto, Modane, Coron, Navarino, and Durazzo. Reversing centuries of frontier history, the Ottomans had achieved naval supremacy in the eastern Mediterranean.
Something kind of a broad brush with like the Napoleonic Wars. Things being straight up, like one-on-one, Britain does not want to risk a land battle against Napoleon. Napoleon does not really want to have a sea battle with the British if he can help it.
Right.
And so here it's like the kind of a similar thing where the Turks don't really want to fight the Venetians at sea, and the Venetians can't fight the Ottomans on land. And suddenly the Ottomans are getting all up in their business at sea, and they're succeeding in doing it.
Yeah, I think a lot of times in naval engagements and just in general, if having the bigger fleet or the better fleet just means that you have more targets to sink sometimes.
Sometimes.
Sort of like when you see like Russia and Ukraine today, like there effectively is no Ukrainian Navy, but they keep sinking Russian ships. So it is kind of one of those interesting things that just because your Navy is bigger, if the other Navy can find a way to operate better, you just give them more targets.
Well, we'll see here in just a bit at the Battle of Preveza how like the Ottomans are pretty greatly outnumbered, but it doesn't really matter because they're tucked into this little gulf. Uh-huh. And there's nothing the Christian fleet can do about it.
They did the reverse Uno reverse card from 300.
Except that in 300, the Greeks don't like burst out of the pass and rout the Persian army.
That is true. That doesn't happen. Can you imagine a Zack Schneider? Isn't he the one that did 300? I think he did.
Did he? I don't know.
Can you imagine him doing a naval warfare version of 300?
Like a Salamis?
Yeah. Yeah, that is Zack Schneider. That movie is so horrible.
What, 300?
Yeah. I mean, it's good and horrible at the same time. Like, would I watch it if it was on TV? Yeah, probably.
It's a fun action movie.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as you keep in mind it's an action movie, not a history movie, right?
So after the end of this conflict in 1503, there's a significant de-escalation between Venice and the Turks. Palmyra Brummett writes of the Venetian fleet.
The fleet did not function primarily as a group of warships. Its purpose was preventative, to escort Venetian merchant convoys and defend the remaining Venetian bases. On rare occasions, a small fleet would be sent to pursue pirates, but such missions were costly and frequently unsuccessful. Rather, the fleet sought to act as a deterrent against attacks from pirates and to ensure the supply of biscuit to Venetian possessions. This being the case, it was not sound policy to attack the Ottomans.
We probably talked about it in the Mary Rose and the Armada, where, you know, at this point, even, you know, like England, there's not really like a Royal Navy per se. It's far more heavily based on privately owned vessels being used for a specific purpose and then given back.
Uh-huh.
Well, like with the Armada, a lot of those ships were personally owned by Drake or by Hawkins. And so kind of the same thing here is like Venice doesn't really want to sink a bunch of money into a specific war fleet, because ideally Venice isn't fighting wars. Ideally, they're trading. They would much rather be doing business than fighting.
Yeah, it's like if you only build a navy that can fight, then all you're going to do is fight with it.
To a city-state with only a hammer. In fact, Venice is benefiting from the presence of a strong Ottoman navy, too, as long as they're at peace. This acts as a deterrent to pirates who are preying on Venetian grain shipments, much of which was actually coming from the Turks.
I mean, that makes sense. If Venetian and Ottoman vessels are the only ones sailing, you should be good to go.
they kind of want the Ottomans to have a good navy there when they're not fighting it. So under Sultan Selim I, the Ottoman Empire saw massive expansion with the conquest of Mamluk Egypt from 1516 to 1517. So this is where they add the Levant, Arabia, Egypt itself. This is like a 40% growth in the size of the empire by adding these things. So now the whole eastern shoreline of the Mediterranean is under Ottoman control. And even like North Africa is sort of nominally under their control. You've got kind of those Barbary states that we see until like the 1800s. They're not directly under Ottoman occupation, but they're aligned with the Ottomans.
Are those some of the pirates that they're referring to in some cases?
Yes.
These are the pirates that Thomas Jefferson will one day defeat, correct?
Ultimately, yes.
I think Bill O'Reilly wrote a book about that.
Wasn't it called Jefferson's War on the Pirates or something?
I thought it was called Killing
Pirates. I don't think it was called Killing Pirates.
Looking it up.
That'd be great.
I bet if I Google killing pirates, it's what
Jesus, killing Kennedy, killing pirates.
No, the first question is someone on Quora asking, can you shoot pirates in international waters?
Wasn't it Brian Kilmeade? Didn't he write that book?
Thomas Jefferson.
It wasn't Barbary Bill O'Reilly.
Pirates book. Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates?
Maybe.
Yep, that's it. Brian Kilmeade.
Oh, man.
Noted history author Brian Kilmeade.
All right. Well, I'm not going to read that.
No, I'm going to have to clear that from my Amazon results so I don't screw my algorithm.
Now we're going to get into, this is kind of the final stage of this episode. The third Ottoman-Venetian War of 1537 to 1540 is the first war with Venice that's of real interest to us in this episode, because it gives us the first naval clash that directly influences our story, and that is the Battle of Preveza. So the Ottoman corsair, Hayreddin Barbarossa, who we referred to earlier, he had been wreaking havoc in the seas around Greece, raiding and capturing Venetian island territories, even extending his raids to the Spanish possessions in southern Italy. He's making himself everyone's problem. And this is where our story gets its first Holy League, organized by Pope Paul III.
Nothing ever goes wrong when the Pope organizes a bunch of European fail sons together.
Well, these aren't the fail sons. All of those guys are in the New World right now.
That's true. They're busy.
Those guys are all being conquistadors. So Paul III, the Pope, birth name Alessandro Farnese, a name, if that name sounds familiar, that's a name he would share with his great-grandson, the Duke of Parma, from our Armada series.
Do you think it's kind of funny that when you look at the nationalities of all the popes, it's kind of like Notre Dame football and the Cleveland Browns football, that they have a bunch of championships early on when it didn't count? Mm-hmm. So like Italy has a ton of popes, but like they probably aren't going to have another one anytime soon.
Italy?
Yeah. Like, I feel like we're going to not have an Italian pope for a minute, right?
Could. Well, I mean, I think Francis has said he plans to retire rather than die as pope.
I just feel like the next one won't be Italian or anytime soon. There's so many other possibilities.
It's true. Like there's more possibilities now than there was at this
point. Like back in the day, it was like a given that it was going to be some Italian dude.
I think there's one Dutch pope. I think one of the Adrians is Dutch.
Really?
It's like around this time, I want to say. There's more options than ever before. You could be Polish. You could be German. Argentinian.
Kind of German.
The South Germans, Argentina.
Are the Germans of the New World.
So yes, our friend, the Duke of Parma from that episode, he is this Pope's great grandson.
Okay.
And I think this is funny because it's like, why does the Pope have kids or grandkids? It's like, don't worry. They're illegitimate. It's not a big deal.
It's fine.
So the Pope called for what was essentially another crusade with the stretch goal of recapturing Constantinople.
That's a big stretch goal.
Just in case.
Like, my stretch goals for this podcast to make me like 10 grand a month. Like, okay.
If you have time, could you capture Constantinople? So the Holy League would consist of Spain, Venice, Genoa, the Papal States. I think that probably goes without saying. And our friends, the Knights of Malta. The Knights of the Malta, my notes say.
So this is essentially Spain and Italy in modern terms.
Basically, that's where like the resources, the manpower are coming from, kind of under the direction of, big picture, the Pope. The Popes will actually play a big role in kind of this whole episode that we'll see with the Siege of Malta, the Battle of Lepanto.
I didn't think Spain ever did anything in the name of a religion, like fighting. This I thought I read true. That on Twitter somewhere this week.
This was an anomaly, really, in Spain's history. Huh. They usually don't like killing people for the church. Quoting here from Roger Crowley.
The Venetians, being pragmatists, tactically preferred the notion of a quick defeat of Barbarossa and a return to peaceful trading with the Islamic world. It was a crucial moment. Southern Europe felt itself hanging in the balance. A decisive Christian defeat now would lay the whole sea open to the merciless raids of the Ottoman fleet.
The Holy League fleet assembled at the Venetian stronghold of Corfu, recently besieged unsuccessfully by the Ottomans. The Venetian fleet was led by Vincenzo Capello, and Genoa was under the command of Andrea Doria. Yes, the guy that the ship was named for.
I honestly thought that it was just an artist or something. I had no idea who, like, what famous person Andrea Doria was even named for.
Famed condottiero and admiral Andrea Doria.
I guess I kind of assumed it was a female. Kind of feels like a female name.
Nope,
like,
that's just Andrew in Italian. Like the soccer player, one of my favorite soccer players, Andrea Pirlo.
Interesting.
We'll also see his nephew in Lepanto, at the Battle of Lepanto. Gian Andrea Doria, who is not as good at as, as he is. Departing from Corfu in September of 1538, the Holy League fleet confronted Barbarossa, where he was holed up with his much smaller fleet at the Gulf of Preveza on the west coast of Greece. So this is literally the exact same spot at the mouth of the Ambracian Gulf where the Battle of Actium had taken place in 31 BC.
Huh.
Unfortunately for the Holy League, Octavian did not leave any of that good fortune lying around anywhere. After hanging out for around 3 weeks with the Ottomans penned up in this gulf, the Holy League fleet decides that it is about time to head home. It's getting late in the season. They don't want to get their ships wrecked in a storm. The evening of September 27th, the commanders decided to turn and head home. But Barbarossa, you know, he's a corsair. He's a pirate. He's very good at chasing down people who are trying to run away from him.
Sort of like what he does.
It's kind like of running his from thing.
It's like running from a jungle cat.
Is like being in this secluded area and then pouncing on a vulnerable target. So the following morning, Barbarossa took advantage of the situation, bringing his fleet out for a battle just as the Holy League fleet was becoming more strung out. Roger Crowley narrates what happened next.
The Venetians, eager for battle, rode forward with shouts of fight, fight. Doria unaccountably kept his squadron back. The lead ships were isolated.
The Venetians had brought a heavily armed galleon in their fleet, which held its own against a swarm of Ottoman galleys. Other vessels were captured and sunk.
When Doria turned towards the battle, he kept his ship well out to sea and engaged only in long-range cannonading. As night fell and the wind shifted, Doria abandoned the fight and withdrew, extinguishing his stern lanterns to foil pursuit. In the words of the Ottoman chroniclers, he tore his beard and took to flight, all the smaller galleys following him.
So not exactly a Hall of Fame performance from Andrea Doria. Not exactly worth having a ship named after him, maybe.
No, not. I hope he did something else at some point.
That honestly seems like something that George would like complain about in that episode. Do research on how he wasn't even that good. So to end part one, let's hear from Auger Gisalin de Busbecq, ambassador. I almost said ambassadeur. To the Ottoman Empire for Ferdinand I, Holy Roman Emperor from 1556 to 1564, for a sense of how things lie up to this point.
I tremble when I think of what the future must bring when I compare the Turkish system to our own. On their side are the resources of a mighty empire. Strength unimpaired, experienced and practice in fighting. A veteran soldiery habitation to victory. Endurance of toil, unity, order, discipline, frugality, watchfulness. Our side is public poverty, private luxury, impaired strength, broken spirit, lack of endurance and training. The soldiers are insubordinate. The officers avaricious. There is contempt for discipline. License, recklessness, drunkenness, and debauchery are rife. And worst of all, the enemy is accustomed to victory, and we to defeat.
So as it stands right now, the Ottomans are in the ascendancy. No one seems like they've got any solutions for the Ottomans. We are gonna see how some of those things change in part two. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
You know, it's not looking good right now for the Pope and his holy warriors. We'll see what the second half holds for him, I guess.
We expect things to continue. That's why we're having this podcast in Turkish right now. Thank you all for listening, and we will be back soon with part two, where we get to the Battle of Lepanto itself. Thank you all for listening. Happy birthday to me, and talk to you again soon.